rehabilitation. Second research symposium on the late effects of poliomyelitis. Tape 7, session number 3 and start of session number 4.
Second day of what I think everyone has agreed has been a provocative meeting to date. This morning, in our first session, we're going to focus on factors that might contribute to the development of the symptomatology that we've been focusing on, namely the post-polio syndrome and how various exogenous agents, in fact, can act on the body, if you will, in its widest sense. We'll have two formal presentations in this session and then two discussants who also will present some material if they wish. We did relatively, but not perfectly well in terms of timing yesterday, and we'll see if we can do a bit better. So it's our first speaker this morning will be Dr. William Ray from Dallas, Texas, who, as listed, will talk about environmental effects on the post-polio syndrome. Bill?
Thank you, Jack. I myself am a victim of what Laurel Halstead has described as post-polio syndrome. And about 15 years ago, I came down with all the signs and symptoms that were described and found I couldn't hardly keep up with my active cardiovascular surgery practice. So not finding much help at the time, we went out and created a research foundation and got some scientists together and saw if we could maybe find some enlightening effects on just chronic disease processes, because at the time I don't think I was smart enough to recognize that this might be post-polio syndrome. And so what I'm going to show you today is some of the principles that have evolved that we've used over the last 15 years on patients with chronic inflammatory diseases and with chronic inflammatory vascular disease and then into the post-polio. I'm going to show you a few facts that we felt one has to know to define these triggering agents scientifically and properly, and some of the tools that we have used. With this. The environmental aspects of health and disease are becoming much more clearly defined, and the adverse influence of environmental incitants on wounded target organs have often been seen by people working in the area of environmental medicine. Because of these observations, a preliminary survey of the environmental influences on post-polio patients who exhibited the post-polio syndrome were done. Now, we used the principle primarily of total body load when we started looking at any of these type patients. And what total body load is, obviously, is the sum total of intake of pollutants that one receives in air, food, and water upon the human. And if you want to sort of divide these into different categories, of course, there's just the biologicals, so things like bacteria and viruses and molds and parasites and foods and so on, or the chemical, which basically are inorganic chemicals and organic chemicals. And of course, the list is ad infinitum, and we'll go into a few of those facts later on. And then there are physical phenomena, like just like heat and cold, and electromagnetic fields and weather changes and radon and so on. These things are taken into our body at all times, and then depending on the individual susceptibility may or may not influence the way the body functions. If you want to picture this body as just a big old barrel, which dumb surgeons have to have little simple analogies to get along, you can. If not, you can use your more erudite ideas. There are a couple other phenomena or principles that we have realized that are very well founded now scientifically, as well as load. We know that, of course, if we cut ourselves out in the garden with a lot of dirt, the first thing we do is wash it to decrease the total body load of bacteria so that we can handle this. This principle is no different than that. We obviously use this every day in the practice of medicine. The second principle is the adaptation phenomena, the adjusting of the body's metabolism to a new set point in order to handle a new substance that comes into the body. The pulmonary docs in the last 10 years like to call this acute toxicological tolerance. There clearly now is a series of over 50, maybe 100 articles in that literature suggesting that there takes about 4 days to get used to a substance. In other words, if you breathe ozone at a higher level, your pulmonary functions may change, according to people like Stokinger and Coffin and others. It may drop down to 20-25%, but by the fourth day, if you continue breathing that same substance or same amount of ozone, your pulmonary functions may be back to normal. This apparently occurs in the vascular tree also, and there may be a long-term trade-off for this acute short-term survival phenomena. This may be how we do survive. So we have found that this principle has been very nice to us in that we can de-adapt people, if you will, by having them avoid the substance for 3 or 4 days and then re-challenge them with it. And in that, you can get a clearly definable cause and effect reaction if it's positive, and you can reproduce this over and over again. So this acute toxicological tolerance principle or adaptation, along with the load, seems to be important to consider when you're doing those studies. The third principle just is the principle of bipolarity, which we wouldn't take much time on. This is just the phenomenon where the body, when it comes in contact with an environmental stimulant, has to induce the immune system, the detoxification systems, and of course, if this goes on for a long period of time, or the virulence of your organisms are very strong, then you will get a depressive phase and really draw on the fuel capacity of the body, things like vitamins and minerals. And the final one is the biochemical individuality. And it appears as if biochemical individuality is made up of several factors, basically genetics, which may be a time bomb waiting for an environmental trigger. All of you know the example of phenylketonuria and how those people do very well until they come in contact with phenylalanine. It may well be that since there are probably over 2,000 metabolic genetic defects, that some of the patients that we see may have some of these minor defects that are waiting for expression in with time, nutritional depletion, or with the right combination of environmental triggers to set the process in order. The other thing is the state of nutrition of the baby in utero and the toxic load of the baby in utero. Lassiter has now shown that in babies, if you measure hydrocarbon levels, for example, things like toluene or xylene or styrene, there may be a bioconcentration in the baby, and therefore increase its total load before it comes out. Now the other thing is the state of the toxic load and the state of nutrition of the individual at the time of exposure. And of course this will vary any day or any year, and therefore may account for some of the fluctuations that we see in some of these patients. So our uniqueness or biochemical individuality, which, of course, the building blocks are made up of just the basic immune system, biochemical enzyme detoxification system, and the vitamins, minerals, proteins, and so on that fuel the systems, which may be quantitatively different. We're looking for normal controls, and if any of you have somebody who's totally asymptomatic without medication, these are the kind of people we're looking at. When we started looking for controls, it was very difficult to find that. We found there are a lot of average people out there, but not what we call somebody who had this full deck. So these are the four principles that seem to have evolved over the period of time that we've studied the patients in the environmental control unit. Now there are a few facts that we felt that one had to realize to do these studies properly. And one was that we found that there were a large amount of nutritional depletion in the environmentally sensitive patients, in that a survey we did on patients coming through our center, we found a lot of people were deficient in B6 and folic acid and B2 and so on, which may well have a lot to do with expression of how they function chronically on a day-to-day basis. The other thing is, if you want to take your three elements that one needs to deal with, according to Environmental Protection Agency studies, there's been no free air or fresh air in the United States in about 20 years. And that very few of us live in pristine areas like this. But if you wanted to take some of the studies and facts that have been gone, look at what's happened here in the last millennium, well, I shouldn't say millennium, in the time since history has been taken. These are from borings from polar ice caps, just showing the level of lead that occurred in the world. Therefore, increase in environmental load that we all have to handle. There was no lead in the atmosphere up until the time of the Romans, who invented lead smelters. And then it rocked along until the Industrial Revolution started, and you can see it was steadily increased until the world became loaded with internal combustion engines, and then it skyrocketed after that. Now, apparently, this has occurred with the other heavy metals as well. And a recent study done in the major cities across the United States for things like lead, cadmium, and zinc. If you look in this column over here, you will see that in the daily air of these major cities, there was a considerable amount of lead and cadmium and zinc. If you get the comparison for national parks, like the first picture that was shown there, and perhaps might be around this area at this time, you can see that they were in the tenths of the percentage points. So there was sometimes orders of magnitude increase in the amount of pollution in the daily air of most of our cities. We all have heard about the disasters in Japan where they've got neurological problems from eating fish containing mercury, the so-called Minamoto's disease. And this was just one example of this. Many of those people died, but many of them survived to have a chronic neurological problems. Now, if you want to move on into the synthetic organic chemicals, there are now 60,000 been invented by our chemists, and a rate of 2,000 per year is now being put into our environment. And as you can see, we're not up to date here, but from 43 to 78, there was a large increase into the billions of pounds. And I think the recent data shows that it has now exceeded our national debt. If we would move on into the second category besides air and show you a few pollutant facts, it's estimated that the average American now eats a gallon of preservatives and additives a year, and including pesticides. According to the recent Environmental Protection Agency studies, which were published about 6 months ago, all of food in the grocery store now contains pesticide or herbicides. Not counting the additives and preservatives that may also be used. When we set up our environmental control program, we did try to find food and contracted with growers to grow in the relative absence of petrochemicals. And you can see that here are some goats that were raised with these being absent, although a couple of them did have some in. These were from flocks brought in other places, so it is possible to do now. Food preparation sometimes can lead to contamination. For example, if you cook on Teflon or gas, this will be absorbed in the food. A nice charcoal grilled fire will put a lot of fuel oil or different substances into your food and can cause problems. Now, moving on to water as the third leg in the stool of pollutant facts, we have had many surveys done now across the United States, and this is just an example of a well and spring water versus a city water that one would see in any area of the country today, where there's a large increment, and this was only done for the most toxic substances, the trihalomethanes and bromines, but some of them are virtual chemical laboratories. In our challenge program, we did use less contaminated waters, either charcoal water, charcoal distilled water, charcoal or distilled water, and or spring waters used in glass because the plastics will bring the phthalates out and some of the other contaminants. Well, with these pollution facts in mind, and the fact that according to many of the EPA studies now that the inside area is probably the most polluted place in our environment due to the fact that we have now sealed our buildings and we don't ventilate them as well, and the buildings don't breathe. The studies now show that the exchange rates may be down into the 2/10 to 3/10 exchanges of air per hour versus 10 in older buildings because of the leakage factor. And the fact that we have continued to exterminate buildings very much so, sometimes to the tune of one time a month, and some people even do it weekly in public buildings. and this is a bioconcentrating or concentrating in the place. And we've also used rapid disintegrating products like foam and formaldehyde rugs and so on, that we went ahead and created a controlled environment. We're now in our fourth generation now in a hospital wing. With the study of materials, using the data from the space labs to show that we could decrease outgassing and decrease disintegration rate to decrease the pollutants in the air, and therefore perhaps subtract the amount of substances in one individual and allow them to go ahead and return to a baseline level, so you could then challenge them and prove scientifically that you could see cause and effect. We basically reinvented the cave, and this is porcelain on fused on steel, and you can see it's very clean, and also we used a ceramic glazed tile as the floor. We had allowed no smoking in there and no perfumes, and used all natural fibers to cut down on variables, and used cotton in the beds, and also for the curtains, we used our Venetian blinds for the windows by using them into two areas of glass so that no dust would accumulate. Then we were able to do serial studies to show that there was some decrease in the pollutants between the rest of the hospital, between homes and this area. It's done in several ways, of course, just by visual, smell, feel, and people who are sensitive to, say, formaldehyde, and they knew it, and they could tell you their reaction were reliable. The fact that there are now several published series out of there where you can show symptomatology clearing in chronic disease processes. By analytic measures using particulate counters, a mass spectrometer, and gas chromatography, showing there was a significant reduction in organic, inorganic chemicals and particulate counts. And then biological responses in patients where you did see changes in eosinophils and T lymphocytes and complement C-reactive protein, seeing them return to normal without doing really anything but the environmental manipulation. Also, we saw changes in pesticide levels in the patient's blood where they would increase initially and then go down lower by the time they were out of the unit. This is, of course, over a period of time of 2 to 3 weeks sometimes. Also, changes in organic solvent levels in the blood. Also, the same thing would happen, and then change in a brain function type test. This just shows a survey of some American populations that we had in there, and you can see the whole gamut of chlorinated pesticides, some of the most toxic substances known to man, were in these patients. And we have done surveys around the world now looking for pristine populations, and did find one in some of the Indians in South America that had very little. I show this slide because this is an example of what one can do with low-level pollutants now. And the thing I wanted you to note is we have done now about 2,000 of these over the last 10 years, and we do have statistics on each one. For example, metbenzene, a known carcinogenic, has been found in 10% of the patients that we see in there. And if you include that with ethylbenzene and some of the other benzenes, it goes up to 25%. The solvents, which are neurotoxins, are also seen in there, which may have some influence in the post-polio patients. You can take the patients, put them in there, don't feed them for 3 or 4 days, let their system equilibrate, they get a little worse, and then they improve. Challenge them with water contaminants, challenge them with individual foods, then challenge them with individual doses of ambient chemicals that would be considered safe on the outside. You can use these challenge booths to deliver the inhaled challenge. You can do it any way you want. And these are some of the doses that one would see or would challenge with. And you can see they're very, very low ones. I'd like to move on into the polio patients now. When Laurel and I first started talking, we decided to do a survey of polio patients in an outpatient area and see if we could determine some triggering of these patients. And they basically were worked up with challenges in the office with individual pollutants after they had de-adapted either by the skin or by inhaled challenge. We had 17 patients. All 17 had lower extremity weakness. They either were on crutches or had different devices to get around. There were only two people that were in wheelchairs. And none of them had the severe respiratory problems like was one of the ones that were presented yesterday. Two patients also had upper extremity involvement in addition to their lower weakness. And then nine patients also had pain, severe pain as their concomitant main complaint, which seems to be maybe a little bit different than some of the bigger statistics pointed out before. After the initial program and a follow-up of 1 year, we had 14 where the symptomatology was gone, and we had one where there was a recurrent symptoms. He would get well for a while, his weakness would go away, his pain would go away, and then something would happen, and for 2 or 3 or 4 weeks he would relapse to his old symptomatology. And then there are two others that really had no change. Now, what incitants did we find that triggered their symptoms? And these, as I said, were done over a period of years so that we were able to have a recurrent map on these people to see if they were reproducible. And the impressive thing about this was that these patients could revert back to their syndrome very rapidly when overexposed to a different substance. For example, many of them were provoked by just the inhalation of molds. All 17 were provoked by chemicals. 16 of these that were tested were by formaldehyde, and these were very low doses, of course, of formaldehyde, the kind you might get out of a carpet like this, or one you might get out of polyester clothes, or from perspirant board, or plywood. Cigarette smoke brought on many of the symptoms in 14 of these patients. We also tested 12 of the patients with the post-polio vaccine. The other five had refused. They were afraid to have this done. And there was just an interesting phenomenon. I don't know what it means, but two of them stated that many times when they got exposure and they'd got their syndrome would start to come on, they could go ahead and take an injection of this vaccine, which is a very dilution, maybe 1 to 625 or 1 to 1,000 and some, and it would pull them out of it. I don't know what to make of it. All I can say is it was observed in two patients. The other three who elected treatment didn't really have any effect on it. The other point that was quite interesting was seven of the patients were triggered by chlorine in very small doses, less than 2/10 parts per million, and they found that they could not swim in their therapeutic pools. That they got worse. They got weak and they got pain afterwards. And this was quite revealing to us because, of course, many of them had pools for that. There were a lot of accessory symptoms. This was obviously fixed for Dr. Brostoff so that he would quit asking those questions. But about a third of the patients did have headaches and dizziness as part of their symptomatology, and you may want to start asking your patients about this. Recurrent sinusitis, a gastrointestinal upset, some of them had severe weight gain, and a lot of them had edema. A lot of these people seem to have the subtle periorbital edema, the cold sensitivity, and sometimes women had the petechiae suggesting vascular phenomena. The other thing we noticed when we started asking the patients the questions were they were odor sensitive. They knew, some of them, that the odor of chlorine, the odor of formaldehyde, or the odor of certain things would trigger their symptomatology and that it did bother them. So there were some clues to that. So in summary, there was a group of post-polio syndrome patients that were found to be sensitive to environmental triggers. Manipulation of these triggers clearly influenced their symptoms, and more studies on the environmental effects of this post-polio syndrome ought to be done, in my opinion, particularly if funding becomes available. Thank you.
It's Bradley, Vermont. Very interesting presentation, but to be sure about those effects, one presumably needs to have reproducibility and double-blind controls for that application and to demonstrate that you get the same on each occasion. Did you have those controls?
Yes. Well, that's why I presented the environmental care program. We've had thousands of double-blind studies in reproducibility on those. In the post-polio patients, we had some blind challenges, but we did not have double-blind because of the situation. They were outpatients in a less controlled area. And, of course, we would like to do that on them. Funding didn't permit that. This this whole study was very expensive because we supplied all the vaccines and everything, no charge and everything, and we just didn't have the funds to put them in the hospital and do them under the double-blind condition. But it's clear that has been done over and over in this type of method, and that's why I showed that. And it's very easy to reproduce this. Yes.
Robin Bielik, CDC. Do I understand that the two patients showed improvement when vaccinated with Salk vaccine, diluted or full strength?
It was diluted, that's what I said.
It was Salk vaccine, inactivated polio vaccine.
Inactivated, yes. So you can think about that.
Jasper Dalby, I'd like to pursue the question that Walter Bradley raised a little bit further, and that is how you can do reliable controls. It's clearly very difficult to control for a trigger with chlorine or cigarette smoke when the patient can recognize it. To adequately control for that, you would have to have simulated cigarette smoke that the patient thought was cigarette smoke but did not have the same elements in it. And I think chemically it's possible to do that. Did you do that kind of a control where something would seem like it to you and the patient but in fact was something different? A related question relates to the second part of your study, which you presented first, that is the effect of putting them in the isolated environment. To control for that, you have to have something that simulates it, but in fact is not a clean environment in which neither you nor the patient knew which they were in. Did you have that kind of a control?
Well, I guess you're asking the impossible, but we did in the phlebitis series. How can we know when we're not in or out of control? We did have the phlebitis patients that we had done and published several years ago with follow-up on, where we had two groups, and we did place one in the hospital and one in the environmental ward, and clearly there was no there was a difference in those patients had done well. We obviously didn't do it to the polio patient. The other thing I think you asked was about the odor of cigarette smoke. When you're dealing with low-level pollutants, and you have to be very careful of what you are using as your placebos, because what we found was is that placebo is not always a placebo. For example, if you take wood smoke and use this in lieu of cigarette smoke and assume this is a placebo at low levels, you may trigger these people because of the aldehydes and the different substances that are similar to the cigarette smoke. So we ended up using saline or filtered water as our placebos for our inhaled challenges in those. And this was over a period of evolution, over a period of years. I think your points are very well taken and they're very difficult to do, but yes, you can mask these odors to the point where people don't know what they are. The other thing is at this level, we ran a series of patients to see if they could pick out what the odor was, because at those low levels in a subtracting area, you can't usually smell the odors. And nobody could. It was statistically non-significant.
Joe Crawford from Manitoba. In addition to the design issues of looking for controls, I think there's an additional dilemma that has to do with the labeling of the way symptom-specific questions are asked in a group that's already defined as post-polio. It's like the written questionnaire given to a group that are already defined as survivors versus a non-specific symptom questionnaire given as a general health instrument. It seems to me that it isn't surprising that the symptom manifestations were talked about in post-polio terms or even physically measurable in those terms, that you might, if you had been dealing with an MS population and done a environmental challenge, their symptomatology in a trial in which they were labeled as MS might well have been expressed in terms of that kind of symptomatology. So I think there's another design issue that's also very relevant.
I would agree with that, and that is another reason for using the individual as his own control, because if you can get him in a basal state without signs or symptoms and then re-challenge him, then you're getting an effect, you're showing an effect. You see, that's the idea. You're entirely right.
Peter Spencer, the implication of your paper is that the environmental pollutants that are of concern are those principally those agents which spew from the smokestack. And yet I wonder whether or not one is possibly missing a critical area for concern and for increased attention, namely the possibility that there may be agents present naturally within foodstuffs which are of potential importance. We do know, for example, that there are motor neuron toxins sitting in certain unusual foodstuffs, that is unusual for the United States, but the cause of tens of thousands of upper motor neuron degeneration in Ethiopia and India. I refer to the chickling pea. We know that cassava, which feeds some 500 million people in the world, can, under certain circumstances, cause ataxic myeloneuropathies. Recently, cycad has surfaced yet again as a very likely possible cause of ALSPD on Guam, in that an unusual amino acid has been identified which is able to produce a primate motor system disease. And so here are just three examples where individuals in developing countries have been exposed to natural chemicals in food who have developed motor neuron conditions subsequently. Now, we assume in the United States that our food is, of course, free of such natural contaminants. Free of such natural compounds. But in fact, no one's ever looked.
Well, some people have looked now, and that was the point of testing food alone, because you're exactly right. We know of alpha toxin in some foods, don't we? I mean, that's very well known at this time. It's very well known to be a toxic poison. We also know, according to Guy Tan's data, that, for example, you take something like millet, there are thyroidogenic compounds to increase thyroid problems in the millet. According to some of Gardner's studies, there are plant phenols now that are very similar to phenylated compounds that we've talked about right here that may well have problems. And I think some of the studies done at Berkeley also had shown some of these toxins. So you're entirely right, and I think that we cannot anymore assume that the water's safe, the food's safe, and the air is safe, and that this is our basis, because I think it's a fallacy, and I think we have to look at those critically if we're going to assess these things.
Dallakas and IH, can you tell us in a second how which diseases have you treated? As I understood, every disease responds, from inflammatory bowel disease to post-polio to phlebitis. I mean, we're not talking about neurotoxins, we're talking about everything, is that correct?
Well, no. You have to remember, I'm talking about the environmental aspects. Not every disease, obviously, responds, and some of them clearly respond more than others, and some of them in the groups respond more than the others. I started out with vascular disease because I'm a cardiovascular surgeon. That's what was sent to me. We all do that, obviously. And so we've dissected out some of those that do well and some of those that don't. I think the concept has come true that there are environmental aspects to living, and that these can influence our disease processes and our health processes, and that if we can define and eliminate those or manipulate them to our favor, we're much better off. That doesn't say it always is going to cure the problem, but some people respond and some won't from that angle.
Munsat, Boston. I'd like to join the chorus of those who urge very strict controls before claiming therapeutic efficacy in any sense. I think those of us who see a lot of post-polio patients are fully aware of the very significant psychosocial stresses that those patients are under. Some of this was discussed yesterday. And that most likely, although no one that I know of has data for it, this group of patients will be very high placebo responders. And I think there are a certain percent of these patients who in fact are out and out hysterics or have conversion reactions. I think we've all had that experience. So I believe we have to be very, very careful. I would join Bradley and Dallakis and the others in urging a very strict controls in any statement about therapeutic efficacy.
I think I would agree with you 100%, but I'll leave this with you. I don't think that hysteria has ever been proved scientifically.
I'm surprised we don't hear a voice from above, from Freud. Bill, thank you for, I think this really brought the audience awake this morning, and we're off to a good start. And we're going to follow along on the theme about these agents affect outside influences on on polio and other diseases. And Dr. Jean Monroe is going to address this next.
Thank you. First of all, thank you very much for the invitation to come here from Britain and to present this data. Part of the work has been sponsored by an organization called the Myalgic and Encephalomyelitis Association of Great Britain, and I'd like to thank them for their grant. We studied a group of people with post-viral syndromes, and it's very informative that this group of people has, a proportion of them have responded to the management that we have had, and this gives us clues as to how other people with post-viral syndromes can respond, so that in fact the information that we have about our group of post-viral people might well apply to more people with post-polio syndrome, and conversely, in fact, information that you find about how to control post-polio syndrome might well apply to a number of the people who are now presenting with a post-viral syndrome. We had 100 patients with the post-viral syndrome, characterized particularly by prolonged malaise, debility, extreme fatigue, and muscle pain, and particularly headache also. And in each case, a history was obtained from these patients that the onset of their problem was a viral infection. The virus infection presented in four major ways. Firstly, epidemic infectious diseases in an institutional community, such as this condition called myalgic encephalomyelitis. And we had groups of patients from three such outbreaks, one which occurred at the Royal Free Hospital in the early 60s, another in a group from the Royal Preston Hospital, which occurred in 1978, and a third in a group in an epidemic in Essex in England. In some of these people, subsequently it was found that they had actually had exposure to Coxsackie B4 viruses, and that there was an abnormal and rising titer of antibodies in some of them. But as it was demonstrated in only some, we have to assume that it could have been that in the others this was the same virus infection. A second group of people that we studied were people with a history of infectious mononucleosis at the onset. And in them, they had a positive Paul Bunnell generally. A third group had a flu-like illness with upper respiratory tract infections, and in a fourth, a gastrointestinal infectious episode at the onset. These groups of people with post-viral syndrome were studied, and also a second group of 10 patients who had had poliomyelitis in their past history and presented, three of them after one of these recurrent virus infections, and the others in the course of our ordinary practice. The group who had had polio in the past presented with increasing weakness, fatigue, and headache predominantly. They had all had the sequelae of the polio with wasting of the limb, a group of limb muscles, and they had presented with what I understand is now the post-polio syndrome. All the patients we studied with the post-viral syndrome complained of malaise, debility, extreme fatigue, headache, and muscle pain. But they also had polysymptomatic complaints. We presented each of our patients with a questionnaire before they saw any of the medical personnel. And this questionnaire contained some 120 questions about their symptomatology, including questions to do with gastrointestinal tract, skin, and so on. And amongst them, many had symptoms of nausea, diarrhea or constipation, abdominal discomfort, especially after meals, bloating, which we find is almost pathognomonic of food sensitivities, and mucus colitis, the irritable bowel syndrome in effect. Some had eczema, urticaria, or itching skin. Many complained of rhinitis, sinusitis, postnasal drip, sneezing, and cough. Some had recurrent upper respiratory tract infections, bronchitis and asthma. Frequency of micturition was a common complaint, and also periorbital edema or dependent edema with puffy feet and hands. Sleep disorders were common, and depression, irritability, mood swings, difficulty in concentration. Common too was recurrent glandular enlargement. Most of these patients had had some restriction of the activities of daily living. They were unable to carry out their normal jobs, or if they were housewives, their normal household duties. The fatigue was extreme at times, but would fluctuate to a certain extent, in that some days they could cope with their activities more than on others. Those who complained of headaches had characteristic migrainous tachypnea, nausea, vomiting, and unilateral headache. Some had nuchal headache or frontal headache. The group who had had a Coxsackie B4 virus infection comprised 25%, those with infectious mononucleosis 42%, and with gastrointestinal or upper respiratory tract infections 33%. The people who had had a post-polio syndrome presented 26 to 35 years after their original virus infectious disease. The weakness previously extant had become aggravated, and they had sporadic weakness which was extreme, and also complained of fatigue and headache and muscle pain. Our questionnaire also included a foods diary, in which we asked whether the foods that people commonly ate and those which they eschewed. And quite often they would record that they had adverse reactions to some foods, particularly alcohol or chocolate, things that they didn't take frequently, but they were not able to identify common food sensitivities. We also had on our questionnaire whether or not they would react in any way to a number of commonly encountered chemicals. And if they answered that they did have symptoms, they would document what their symptoms were to exposure to particular chemicals. And amongst them were diesel, perfume, tobacco smoke, cleaning agents, industrial chemicals or workplace chemicals, and newsprint. Now, I'd like just to show you the commonest symptoms which we documented. Lethargy, depression, anxiety or mental confusion, nausea and bloating after meals in 87%, muscle and joint pains in 66%, sore throat 54%. Quite often they actually said they ate for comfort. The standard investigations we undertook were these: pathology and biochemistry profile, T lymphocyte subsets, immune complexes, urine analysis, mineral analysis for their nutritional status, and other investigations when necessary. And amongst the T lymphocyte subset indices that we had, we showed that there were some abnormal levels, which I hope that we will ask Dr. Brostoff to discuss shortly. We can come back to that.
This is the end of side one. Please turn the tape over now and continue listening on side two.